This recording is a production of Faith Builders Educational Programs. This presentation was recorded at REACH 2015, a conservative Anabaptist ministry convention hosted by Faith Builders on March 19 and 20, 2015.
Welcome. I have to tell you, this is a little scary because sitting in this audience are people who are on my team right now. Let me remind you of what this workshop is about. Each of us as women bring our unique blend of gifts and passion to a team. Sometimes those differences grate instead of nurture and bless. We want to learn ways of embracing our diversity rather than allowing it to divide and irritate. As I was putting this together, I started to think about the various motivations for you being in this workshop. And we're going to talk about that. I'm going to throw some questions at you, some of the things that might have motivated you to come. It was a little, maybe just a little unsettling to me as I thought about why you might be here and what draws you to this particular subject. Are there specific women either here today at REACH or at home that you wish would be interested in a workshop of this nature? Have you been jealous or competitive of other women on your team? Have you secretly wished that a certain woman would not be on your team? Maybe you've blamed the men on your team for how the women interact. And maybe it's none of the above. I'm glad you're here. While you think about some of those questions, I thought it might be helpful for you if I would just chronicle my experience as a team member. And I'm a little nervous about the length of this workshop, okay? I really want to be able to throw questions at you and let you respond, but I also know that we're going to have to hustle, I think, to get done. So bear with me. I'm going to go over this part very fast. But this has been my experience as a team member. In the early years of our marriage, and for probably 20-some years of it, we regularly were on staff at a winter Bible school. We participated in two different ones. And so our times there at them varied in length from 3 weeks to sometimes 3 months in the winter. And obviously that placed us in very close and daily interaction with other administrators and teachers. In fact, pretty much all day, okay? We ate together, we played together, we prayed together, we laughed and cried together. But each year, it was basically a short-term situation and staff varied. So it wasn't always the same staff. And you know how it is when you know it's short term. Even if somebody aggravates you or grates on you, you can ride it out for 3 weeks, 3 months, or whatever. Then in the year 1982, John was ordained at age 30. His was an itinerant position until 89, when he accepted what was supposed to be a temporary pastoral position. At the particular church we were attending, there was occasional turnover in leadership. So that meant working alongside numerous different people and sometimes family members. And as you might know, that packs its own set of dynamics. In 94, we moved to Ohio to start a counseling center. And there, in addition to a pastoral team, we also had the ministry team, and we were there for 12 years. The next move in 06 took us to where we actually are currently living in PA. And as we came more and more involved at Faith Builders, again, we found ourselves working on a leadership team. So most of my married life, I would say, has involved working on a team. Now, does that qualify me to speak on this subject today? Not necessarily. No! Not necessarily. I'm not up here because I'm qualified. I'm up here because I think Jesus has asked me to be. Did I always do the team player thing perfectly? No. I made many mistakes, as well as sometimes getting it right. But you know what? I think Jesus doesn't always or necessarily call because we are good at something or know how to do it. But maybe he calls when we actually recognize that we can't do it. It was while we were living at one of the previously mentioned places that one of our fellow team members, she wore a dress, by the way, she confronted me about something in my life that made team playing difficult for her. And that was a very difficult thing. It was necessary, but it was difficult. So as a result of that conversation, for a long time in front of my sink, I had posted a note reminding me of what I needed to work on. One of the benefits of working on a team is the potential for developing the kind of intimate relationships where there is a freedom to confront in that way. There's also it also provides a platform for the receiving of those kind of confrontations, okay? We're capable of hearing hard things when we know with certainty that someone is committed to us, that someone loves us, appreciates, and accepts us for who we are. We can hear from them when they call us to deeper, better things. This same lady one day had a mini emergency of sorts at her house. I don't remember all the details, but I think maybe she had an unexpected company. And she needed bread. And since I wasn't home, she came to my house and she helped herself to my freezer. Was that okay? You know, I really don't remember feeling invaded or taken advantage of by her. Actually, what I felt was more honoring. That she would be comfortable enough in our relationship to do that and know that it was okay. Now, don't misunderstand these stories. Things didn't always go smoothly between us. We had our differences. We had our differences as couples. And you know this, most teams that you work on will be like that. You'll serve alongside of ladies who aren't like you, who are more gifted than you are, who can get along better with certain ladies than what you can, who have more charm, who can stay more cool in heated situations, and who just plain can do it better than you can. But that's not really a point, is it? Is it? Isn't it more about learning to be okay with who I am? Learning to be okay with who she is? And, you know, that's still not saying it right. It is embracing and cherishing who she is, even though she's different than you. Our differences are what really make us effective as a team. You really need to get that. Our differences are what make us effective as a team. And so often, instead, our differences are what turn us quickly into rivals. You know what? I should do a little disclaimer here. I purposely chose not to do a PowerPoint or overhead, but I know with the kind of handout I gave you, that can be tough. So I will try and, if you miss, as we go along and you miss the blanks, raise your hand or something and we'll help each other. So our differences are what make us effective as a team. Let me illustrate it this way. Think about a cooking or a catering team, okay? Does everyone on that team cook? Does everyone on that team bake? Does everyone know how to put together a beautiful, gorgeous salad with strawberries and everything? Does everyone know how to set a classy table? No. We can all do those things when we have to, but we do have our strengths, and each one is gifted differently. That's exactly why they make a good cooking team, okay? Because one can do one thing better than the other. Diversity puts them in different positions and with different responsibilities, but they're working toward the same end, okay? Making and serving a colorful, tasty meal. This is my hand, right? Four fingers and even a thumb. Each one serves a different function, okay? I rarely use this as my pointer, okay? I don't dig in my ears with this one. They serve a different function. They serve a separate purpose. Each has its particular job to do. Each is important. And they cooperate with each other, okay? They're not working against each other. 1 Corinthians 12:12 says, Christ's body is one, but it has many members. Each serves a different purpose. Each is important. Each has a particular job to do. But they each better cooperate with each other. Now, you're wondering when you get to eat your M&Ms, right? We're going to do a little exercise first. So, pull them out, get them in front of you. We're going to do a little quiz. What I want you to do is think about another lady on your team, okay? Now, you don't know if this should be one of your good friends or your worst rival, if you have one, okay? And I'm not going to tell you. Just pick a lady on your team. Now, hopefully you all are on a team of some kind, okay? If you're a teacher's wife, there are ladies on your team, okay? Think of a lady on your team. Pick her out. Do you have her? Does anybody not have anybody in mind yet? Do you need more time? You can't switch midstream, okay? It's one lady. Do you have her? Anybody not have her? Okay. This is what you're going to do. I'm going to ask you a few questions about your interactions with this particular lady in the last 1 to 3 months. Not longer than that. Okay? And if you have trouble remembering, just estimate as closely as possible. Nobody's checking up on you. But this is a private exercise. Okay? Try to be as accurate and honest as you can. Most importantly, do not pay attention to your neighbor. This is not meant to embarrass anybody, okay? So, it's just meant to for you to get a help you get a look at a particular relationship, okay? No peeking. Take one piece of candy out of your bag and lay it on your lap. Don't hold it in your hand, of course. Lay it in your lap. If, in this time frame that I've talked about, if you have shared a hug with her. Tell me if I go too fast, okay? Because I would really like to keep moving. Take one piece of candy out of your bag if you have. Do you have a question? Are you okay? Shared words of appreciation. Okay, can be email, a note card, in person. This is either if you've shared it with her or received it from her. Take one piece of candy out of your bag if you've spoken highly of her behind her back. Take a piece of candy out of your bag if you've exchanged a gift or a service, as in a loaf of bread, Not that you gave her one and she had to give you one, but if one way or the other, you shared a loaf of bread, shared a meal, made a meal for her, maybe exchanged babysitting, worked together making Christmas cookies or whatever, if you did something like that with her in the last 3 months. Take a piece out if you sat down over coffee. Take a piece out. Am I going too fast? Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah. I just think coffee, not tea. Take a piece out if you prayed for her. Not necessarily in her presence, just if you've prayed for her. Take a piece of candy out if you have entered her home or had her in yours. Now, with the second part, it's very important that you understand that these things are not necessarily taboo that I'm going to say to you, but it does have the potential for draining energy in the relationship. So, what you're going to do is put a piece of candy back in, if, okay? Now, if you run out of candies, don't panic. You might, okay? But it's going to tell us something about the relationship. Put a piece of candy back in your bag if you have disagreed significantly on a particular issue. Put a piece of candy back in your bag if you have shared an event without saying a word to each other. Put a piece of candy back if you were corrected by her. Put one back if you spoke about her in frustration, either to your spouse or to another friend or whoever. Put one back if you felt embarrassed by her words or her behavior. Put a piece back if you procrastinated or in other ways avoided contact with her. Put a piece back if you regretted what you said to her. Now, ponder a little bit where the candies are, okay? And think about that particular... Yes? Oh, 1 to 3 months. As you think about what's in the bag, what might be in your lap, how many you had to put, how do they balance, okay? Are there more positives in your relationship with her than there are negatives? That's what you need to be weighing. And now I want to ask you if there's anything that you would feel inclined to share about. Was there anything enlightening in that exercise? Maybe there has been uncomfortableness in the relationship, but you haven't really stopped long enough to try and figure it out. Has it done anything? What is it doing inside of you, if anything? I know this is very vulnerable. And you don't have to say anything, and that I'm okay with that.
I think it's just helped me realize that what I thought was the other person's problem, I haven't done enough to reach out to that person. And maybe it's my own problem. Mm-hmm.
Good, thanks. We're going to move on. We could ask the question, okay, is it important that team wives not only get along but actually enjoy each other? And if they don't, will the people under us know? Let's think about the food team again. For them to be effective, they not only have to be cooking the same meal, but they need to be helping each other as well, cooperating, okay? They can't be jerking spatulas out of each other's hands, hogging the KitchenAid, the cutting board, the sink, the best knives. Instead, they share utensils. They share counter space. They share oven times. They learn to appreciate that she can make the smoothest mashed potatoes because she knows she can't, and that frees her up to do something that she can do well and that she enjoys more. We can talk about these physical food, making food, okay, but if we move away from that and turn to spiritual gifting and start our comparing, we quickly lose our desire to affirm and appreciate. We easily go to comparative thinking. We're tempted to under-spiritualize her. Because we all know that a singing gift is not nearly as good as a speaking gift. Well, who says so? Doesn't God hand out the gifts the way he wants to? If I have a fear in this workshop, it would be that you're going to walk out those doors and say, or feel, think, it's too simplistic. Relationships just aren't that easy. And I know that. I know good relationships take steady attention. They're hard work. But I also have to say that when I follow Jesus' principles for getting along, it's really easier than I sometimes make it out to be. And so that's what we're going to be looking at today. As I studied for this and got input on it, I took what I thought was important for good team relationships and divided it into two categories. And some of this, seriously, we've heard a good bit on already in these 2 days. One being things we do, or practices, you can see that now on your handouts, and the other being how we feel, or attitudes. And I have not made my lists long. I've kept them very short. Therefore, they are not exhaustive. But let's get started. We're going to start with attitudes. To me, a significant piece of getting along is humility. If I, as a team member, am haughty, arrogant, think my ideas are better, and I'm regularly shooting down hers, even just in my head, I'm a problem. Even if I am the bishop's wife, and she is just the deacon's wife. Or maybe I'm the principal's wife, and she's just a teacher. The more significant one's role, the more need to practice humility. And humility is more than just the absence of pride, okay? It's a recognition of who I am and who I am not. I am under authority, and I am not the final word. And the temptation for us as women especially is to use our position for personal advantage, to establish identity, instead of remembering that my personal worth is because of who I am in Jesus, not because of something I do or a position that I hold. If I give in to the temptation to use position to promote myself, I become a problem on a team. If I take what Jesus has called me to do and turn it into a way to elevate myself, I'm defeating and hindering his purposes as well. It has then become about me, not about what he can accomplish through me in this particular period of history. James 3:15-16 in the New Living says, "For jealousy and selfishness are not God's kind of wisdom. Such things are earthly, unspiritual, and demonic. For wherever there is jealousy and selfish ambition, there you will find disorder and evil of every kind." Those are hard words. Those are not my words. I don't think I could stand up here and say that jealousy and selfishness are demonic. But James does. So what do I gain by the sin of comparison? Well, most of the time, either pride or despair. If I compare myself with her and I'm up here, then I quickly can go to arrogance. If I compare myself with her and I'm down here, it's just a depressing, despairing, hopeless place. Comparing rarely takes us good places. Now, ponder very carefully what I'm going to say next. If I, and some of this I have borrowed from Susie Larson in her book, Your Beautiful Purpose. If I, as a two-talent girl, begin admiring a five-talent girl, and we do, and I think that's okay, but because I'm a woman, that admiration can quickly translate to envy and rivalry and jealousy. And the reason that something stirs within us when we see good qualities in her is because we recognize honorable qualities. That's a good thing. And when we see them, we want them too. What if, instead of it being turning us into rivals, what if we could hear Jesus whispering, "She has something I really want to give you. You recognized it, you saw it, you admired it. Can you embrace that gift I've placed in her?" How you steward what you see in others will determine what I can entrust to you. Imagine Jesus saying that. How you steward what you see in others will determine how much I can entrust to you, as though Jesus is speaking this. So, are you following what I'm trying to say here? This is not Jesus anymore. This is me. You don't know those qualities you admire in her, those things that she can do so well. You have no idea what responsibility goes with that. You don't know what temptations go with that. You don't know what her call requires of her. Because with great gifting comes great responsibility. So, what if, instead of rivaling her, you would take up the call to pray for her, to pray protection over her, because her giftings can also be her downfall. And it just may be your prayers that keep her. How different might our lives be if we could think in our relationships, in our threatening relationships, if we could think in those terms instead of feeling the jealousy and the envy that we sometimes do. Stewarding well the gifts in her while waiting expectantly for Jesus maybe to give them to us. It's a lovely thought. I'm going to open it up. Do you want to shoot that down? Do you want to add anything? So I'm saying humility is important. That's not a new thought. My second point is not a new thought. Gratitude. I think to be good team members, we have to be grateful team members. And we've already heard about humility. We've heard about gratitude, and I feel almost redundant, and I'm not going to spend a lot of time on it. But seriously, it feels to me like gratitude is a close runner-up to humility. Let me say it this way. As I have a proper perspective of who I am and what I am about, and recognize that I am quite undeserving of anything that he has given me, of everything he's given me, then I'm in a place to experience contentment and not be hankering for her gifts or more. I'm able to receive his gifts with gratitude, knowing that that's just what they are, gifts. Given not because of anything I am, but because he is so generous. So when I am grateful, In addition to being humble, it makes it easier to accept the differences in her. I say that because it helps me to understand that God had purpose for placing us on the same team, and He wants to perfect me through her. You heard right. He will use her to shape you. And when I embrace that as truth, that He put her there to make me a better person, then I can experience gratitude that she's on my team, that she's in my life. Let's go to practices, things we do. Loving service, okay? If I can remember that my role is that of a servant, it will keep me from unhealthy attitudes, and it will prod me towards certain behaviors. And you know what? We could talk for a long time on Jesus, our perfect example. And we're not going to turn to it, but I think it's John 13, where He kneels in front of His disciples, and He actually washes their feet. Ladies, this is a king. This was the job of a household servant. But He wraps His towel around Himself, as a lowly slave would do, and proceeds to wash their dusty feet. And one of them resists. And you know what? I think I would have too. But as He gently washes their feet and probably speaks to them with words, teaches them with words, He's also teaching by His example. Now, are you getting the visual? If you're struggling with that, put yourself on the chair, okay? And the Savior. Kneels at your feet. The only man who qualifies for the shedding of perfect blood. The audacity of that scene. Just makes me want to turn my face away and hide my eyes. How is it possible that someone so great could stoop to something so lowly? What was He trying to teach? Was His call to wash each other's feet deeper than the obvious? How would He want me to wash my team members, ladies' feet? What would that look like every day of the week? And this can almost be worse. When she washes yours, are you able to perceive it authentically and receive it humbly? Let me remind you of what you already know. You may perform many acts of service and still be missing the servant heart. Loving service. It's possible to serve and not love. It is not possible to love and not serve. To love is simply to act. Loving service means I will see and respond to the needs of those around me, yes, even those team member wives who rub me the wrong way. It is possible to serve and not love. It is not possible to love without serving. Loving service means I will not flaunt my abilities and resources, but I will offer them appropriately. Loving service means I will get my hands dirty if necessary without the need to be noticed, thanked, or affirmed, and I will do it out of love, not obligation. Loving service combined with humility means that no act of helpfulness is beneath me. Remember Jesus' words in Matthew 20, whoever wants to be great, let him be your minister, as in the person who not preaches, the person who gives when there's a need, who gives aid, Whoever wants to be chief, let him be your servant. So greatness doesn't come by being served. That's not what makes you great. It comes by serving. So be givers. And for people to be givers, there have to be receivers. So we have to be gracious receivers as well. Okay, so I'm saying loving service is important. Number two, I would say it's also important that we give encouragement. And I suppose all of us could tell stories of the things we've heard with our very own ears, either words that stifle or words that help us take our next breath. We know the difference. We understand how words either kill something inside of us or give us energy to do the next thing. And I'm not going to elaborate on this point except to tell you a story. Some years ago, we had a son who made some very wrong decisions, choices that took his life in a direction other than what we wanted it to go. And it translated into a very dark time for John and I. And it was sometime during that time, or maybe shortly after, that I was in a conversation with a young lady. She was actually a student at FB. And she was not a girl that I interacted with regularly, so I was surprised when our conversation went below the superficial. As I recall, she'd asked me a question maybe about my life or schedule or something, and it turned into me sharing how difficult it had become for me to be in a public speaking position. How I felt like I had more questions than answers. And all of this because I felt like such a failure as a parent. And I don't recall what all she said or how much she said, but I remember one sentence. I'll probably never forget it. She said, God has many wayward children, and he is not a failure. It changed my perspective, and it brought courage to my heart. The words we use on others, you know, sometimes it's easier to give them out to people that we're not as close to, okay? But to give them out to the women that we work sometimes side by side with every day or every week or whatever, those sometimes are harder. Your words have the potential for enabling others to keep on when life is tough. So I ask you, are you an encourager? Are you an encourager for the ladies on your team? Do your words offer life or do they offer death? So, as team players, we hopefully, joyfully, and willingly serve. We offer encouragement when that is necessary. A third thing that I think is important is we must offer, many times, we must offer forgiveness. The people on your team just aren't always going to get it right. That's point three, in case you're missing it. There's going to be times when they hurt you. There probably will be times when they don't treat your husband the way you think they should. And how are you going to survive what feels to you like condescension or insults? How can we turn injury and hurt into an opportunity to forgive? I think only by recognizing that whatever comes to me, God has already screened. He's looked at it. He said she can handle this. She can take this. I can forgive when I've been hurt because I recognize, if I recognize, that God has a plan in it. And believing that those who wrong me are his tools for refining me. If I hold to that belief system every day, then it's much easier to forgive. Unfortunately, or fortunately, whatever your perspective, as you work alongside of people, you'll have ample opportunity to develop the art of forgiving. Some time ago, I heard this story. It is an incredible story of forgiveness. I hope I can read it without weeping. Imagine this scene from a courtroom trial in South Africa. A frail black, that's important for you to remember, a frail black woman stands slowly to her feet. She is something over 70 years of age. Facing her across the room are several white security police officers, one of whom, Mr. Vanderbrock, has just been tried and found implicated in the murders of both the woman's son and her husband some years before. It was indeed Mr. Vanderbrock. It has now been established. Does anybody know this story? Okay. I'm going to read it anyway. Some of you don't. It was indeed him who had come to the woman's home a number of years back, taken her son, shot him at point-blank range, and then burned the young man's body while he and the officers partied nearby. Several years later, Vanderbrock and his cohorts had returned to take away her husband as well. For many months, she had heard nothing of his whereabouts. Then, almost 2 years after her husband's disappearance, Vanderbrock came back to fetch the woman herself. How vividly she remembers that evening, going to a place beside a river where she was shown her husband, bound and beaten, but still strong in spirit, lying on a pile of wood. The last words she heard from his lips, as the officers poured gasoline over his body and set him aflame, were, "Father, forgive them." And now this woman stands in the courtroom and listens to the confessions offered by Mr. Vanderbrock. A member of South Africa's Truth and Reconciliation Commission turns to her and asks, "So, what do you want? How should justice be done to this man who has so brutally destroyed your family?" "I want three things," begins the woman calmly but confidently. "I want first to be taken to the place where my husband's body was burned." "So..."
"I'm so sorry. I was going to tell you, you could eat your M&Ms.
Boy, I got caught up in this topic and missed that. Well, you can now. "I'm sorry. I want first to be taken to the place where my husband's body was burned so that I can gather up the dust and give his remains a decent burial." She pauses, then continues, "My husband and son were my only family. I want secondly, therefore, for Mr. Vanderbrock to become my son. I would like for him to come twice a month to the ghetto and spend a day with me so that I can pour out on him whatever love I still have remaining in me." And finally she says, "I want a third thing. I would like Mr. Vanderbrock to know that I offer him my forgiveness because Jesus Christ died to forgive. That was also the wish of my husband, and so I would kindly ask someone to come to my side and lead me across the courtroom." "So that I can take Mr. Vanderbrock in my arms, embrace him, and let him know that he is truly forgiven." As the court assistants come to lead the elderly woman across the room, Mr. Vanderbrock, overwhelmed by what he has just heard, faints. And as he does, those in the courtroom, friends, family, neighbors, all victims of decades of oppression and injustice, because they're black, begin to sing softly but assuredly, "Amazing Grace, how sweet the sound." Here's your takeaway from this workshop. Don't let differences and irritations deaden your heart to the deep need you have for connection with your fellow sisters. Thank you.
Thank you, Barb. Thank you, all of you, for coming. And you're dismissed now. This is the last of the workshops for the day program. So God bless you as you go from here.
This recording is a production of Faith Builders Educational Programs. This presentation was recorded at REACH 2015, a conservative Anabaptist ministry convention hosted by Faith Builders on March 19 and 20, 2015.